This is XTP Media.
Nobody had really written about the Falklands Air War since the records have been declassified. Being the kind of obsessive that I am, I had to go through them and see what I could find. It was sort of panning for gold.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Takeoff. So, here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 99 of Aerospace Radio Station, Extended. Today, I'm joined by Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society, and Tim is Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine. Tim, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Hope everybody is also well and staying safe and keeping home.
Yeah, and staying home this evening, as we record, is Gareth Stringer, Editor at Global Aviation Resource. For those of you who know Gareth, he works for the health service here in the UK, and he's been working very, very long hours, so needs a little bit of rest before he's back in the early hours tomorrow. So we wish Gareth well. Our heart goes out to the work that he and his colleagues are doing. But we are also joined by international best-selling author Roland White. Roland is a familiar guest here on Extended, and he's simply written some of the best aerospace and aviation books ever, and that's a fact. Into the Black, Vulcan 607, Phoenix Squadron, Stormfront, and The Big Book of Flight, to name a few. Today, Roland's back to talk about his latest book, Harrier 809, Britain's legendary jump jet and the untold story of the Falklands War. Always fun and a pleasure. I never come away without learning something new from you, Roland. Welcome back to Extended.
Thank you very much indeed. That's quite an introduction. I'll do my very best to live up to it.
Now, I think it's four or five times, isn't it, on the show now. Yeah. I've just been running through my list.
I think this might be the fifth time.
Wow.
I'm sure this is a crack I made last time, but you know, nothing original here, I can promise you. It makes me an ace, doesn't it, if this is my fifth appearance?
It does. So we're going to have to make you an ace. We'll put an ace picture in your profile on the show notes. Welcome back, Roland. Great to have you. Okay, let's get started by looking at a few items that caught our attention in the news. After that, we're going to talk to Roland about his book. We'll then do some shout outs and promote some bits and pieces in the industry before wrapping up. So let's crack on. Our first story is the ongoing crisis that we're all facing, has seen the cancellation of some significant air shows and airfares. Farnborough and Riyadh have gone from the UK. Tim, how much of an impact is this going to have on the industry, losing Farnborough out of the cycle?
Well, it's really unprecedented, isn't it? I mean, as we're looking now, this is the worst crisis for air travel since, Second World War, dawn of the jet age. And Farnborough, along with, Paris, they're always the highlights. They're always the special, Super Bowl of exhibitions, or the Olympics of exhibitions. And that's where the industry comes together. That's where sort of deals are kind of announced, where people you know, the global industry comes together. So it wouldn't be a decision that they'd take lightly. You know, it means the next big air show is probably going to be sort of, you know, Paris 2021. So we already saw it in February when the Singapore Air Show was on. There was a few companies that had dropped out. A few American companies had decided, well, we're not entirely sure about this. And that was before, you know, it had really been, you know, the coronavirus has been really upgraded to a pandemic. So, you know, understandable decision. And also you have to think, well, what, you know, even if it did go ahead and you had restrictions lifted, what are people really going to be talking about when the airlines are in such a, you know, sort of crisis? No one's going to be sort of announcing big orders. It's really sort of like odd time to kind of launch, you know, some kind of new venture and things like that. So, yeah. And also, you've got the oil price at all-time low. You know, that's also like it's all happening at once. You've got the 737 MAX still grounded. It would be an odd show anyway, even if it was going ahead.
And Tim, we've seen in the news our friend Stelios, who was the founder of EasyJet. I think he still owns about a third of the business, threatening to try and oust members of the board if they don't cancel their $4 billion order with Airbus for future aircraft. How crazy is it, are things getting? Are we going to see more of this coming through? I mean, he's saying that the value of that order is bigger than the capitalization of EasyJet and will literally wipe the organization out. Is this a story that is going to be a common factor for other airlines?
There's going to be other airlines that are either cancelling or deferring outright their orders. I mean, for the UK government, for EasyJet, the particular case of EasyJet, they're kind of caught in the middle. In the one hand, they've got, you know, Airbus. They want to support Airbus, and they also want to support EasyJet. You've got to, it's quite a sort of odd situation of how we get out of that kind of Gordian knot of, do you take these aircraft when you don't need them,
yeah,
or you know, and hold up your end of the bargain, or do you cancel them outright and then therefore push it back onto Airbus, and you know, then there's UK jobs. Potentially, yeah, you know, yeah. That's an effect on UK jobs. You know, maybe there's a way where it can be negotiated where they'll take them eventually, and they'll just be sort of delayed. You know, the capacity will come back. You know, one of the things, at least I get the sense from in this sort of dread, well, you know, this sort of crisis, is we've been 3 weeks here into a UK lockdown, and people are already going up the walls, and you know, boredom and being stuck inside. I've got a feeling that when restrictions are lifted, even if it's to certain countries or to say, all right, you can only go X, Y, or Z, or you know, this country is out of bounds, or this country's still got barriers up, I've got a feeling that air travel will rebound very, very quickly, because people will be sort of desperate for a holiday. Oh, you know, desperate to get out somewhere different.
Well, I've got to say, I've got a book in later in this year. I'm praying comes off, and I know Gareth has too. But there's some great good news stories going around at the moment. Both the major airframers are doing some good stuff. I mean, Boeing's using its Dreamlifter to transport equipment. Airbus is printing 3D face visors, and some of the airlines have done the best they can, you know, turning their hand to cargo, staff going to work for health services. There's some really fantastic stuff coming out of the industry as well, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, it really also shows the best of what the industry and aviation can do, you know, pulling together. You know, repurposing, you know, their manufacturing, their immense manufacturing capability, and all of a sudden you've got the, you know, the top engineers of the you know, in the country, sort of like, you know, top engineers of aerospace and F1. You know, that's the two of the crown jewels of British engineering.
Yeah,
and they're looking at, well, how do we make a more efficient ventilator? You know, how do we get these? How do we get the, you know, better masks, things like that? So that's really sort of you know, kind of powerful story, and something to give you kind of hope for the future that that you know, once the aviation industry wakes up and kind of turns its muscle to some kind of challenge like this, then we'll get the coronavirus licked.
Yeah. Well, let's move on then. Although the industry isn't as active as we've known it, there's still lots of stories around. This one caught our eye and we shared with Tim Davies, actually, which was quite fascinating to see the feedback. Fighter jet crash averted by defect in civil ejection incident. 20th of March this year, civilian passenger was accidentally ejected from a twin-seat Rafale B fighter in eastern France. The report is out. Now, to say the report is a catalogue of failures is probably an understatement. The story aired on aerotime.aero. We'll put a link in the show notes to that. But everything that could go wrong probably did.
I mean, it's weird how this has kind of got a lot of traction. I think, you know, a scarcity of other aviation stories apart from coronavirus stuff has probably like helped promote it. But one thing that strikes me, I mean, you know, the wasn't strapped in properly, wasn't given the proper briefing, didn't really want to be given a ride.
Didn't want to go, jet, did he?
Didn't want to, you know, and couldn't really sort of say he'd turn it down. Pilot told, don't, whatever you do, don't do negative G, did negative G. And then finally, you know, grabs onto the bang seat, probably because there's a bit of a negative G in the power climb, and hangs onto the wrong part of the airplane to hang on to, and bang goes out the back. And even then, something fails. And what should have happened is the pilot should have quickly followed him, but there was some kind of a fault in the ejection system, and the pilot's still there, and he's now got a cabriolet. So it comes home, lands the aircraft. I think there's going to be real sort of like, you know, questions there, and there'll be some you know, pretty stern talkings to at the French Air Force as to that particular unit as to, well, you know, what exactly were you playing out folks here. And I'd also be interested from Roland, you've flown in fast jets, haven't you?
Yes. Yeah.
What was your myself as well, you know, I've been lucky to. What was your kind of briefing for? I mean, you know, I seem to remember being given lots and lots of, you know, you strap in here, strap in there, don't touch this, don't touch that.
And I mean, you know, the most kind of important detail was that, you know, right from the outset, I really, really wanted to do it. You know, there's nobody pressuring to jump into a fast jet. You know, I mean, it was something I was incredibly eager to do, and had some understanding, I suppose, of what it was that was being explained at great length. I mean, I've got sort of a couple of photographs of me sitting in the ejection seat that they had in the briefing room, which was there specifically to sort of talk me through exactly how it worked, exactly how to make it safe, the circumstances in which I would have to pull a handle, what would happen next as a result. I mean, you know, there was absolutely nothing slapdash about it at all. And that was incredibly reassuring. But all of it was underpinned by my eagerness to get into the air. You know, there was not a single part of me thinking, God, I hope this is over soon and it all goes okay. There's also a kind of demon on the other shoulder, sort of thinking, wow, ejecting would be something, wouldn't it?
You know, the thing that's pressed into you in the briefings, you know, I mean, you know, obviously a lot of it goes through, you're so kind of pent up with excitement and apprehension and all the rest of it. But the one thing that does go through, you know, stays in your head is those yellow and black handles. Yeah. I better not touch them unless, you know, something really, really does go wrong. And I better keep my hands clear of anything that is labeled yellow and black, because that would be a bad thing.
Yeah. I mean, you just don't go near, do you? You're sort of briefed and kind of almost conditioned to pull it automatically when you hear eject, eject, eject. But that aside, you do everything you can to avoid going anywhere near them.
Roland, what was the aircraft type you flew in?
It was a Hunter, and then a Buccaneer.
God, a Buccaneer. Wow. I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was years ago now. I was very, very lucky to get down to Thunder City when I was writing Phoenix Squadron. So
it was course, a sort of proper
two birds with one stone. I went down there. I mean, it was research for Phoenix Squadron. Well, that's how I justified it to my wife. My BG head was very generous with the deal he offered me, and I managed to interview Dick Lord while I was down there, who, as some listeners will remember, I mentioned in Phoenix Squadron, was at VF-121 at Miramar when the Top Gun school was set up. And while he wasn't directly involved with Top Gun, he did write a document, actually, which I'm holding now. Somebody asked me if they could see it, called Flying and Fighting the Phantom, which he wrote in June 1968 when he was at Miramar. There's a great little line here at the beginning. He says, air crews designated to fly the Phantom have a unique choice. They can fly the most cumbersome dog ever built, ever to take to the air, or they can fly the best and most potent fighter ever built. Phantom leads a Jekyll and Hyde existence. When flown incorrectly in the combat environment, the aircraft is no match for the fighters likely to oppose it. But provided the aircrew realize both its limitations and its massive capability, the F-4 becomes, without a doubt, the very best fighter flying today. Dick Lord, who was in the Royal Navy, South African, was in the Royal Navy, flew off Eagle Sea Vixens, then returned to South Africa after his stint on exchange at Miramar as Top Gun was being set up, and joined the South African Air Force and ended up running the war in Angola for the South African Air Force. So he had a long and storied career, and I was very, very fortunate to meet him down in Cape Town alongside that extraordinary flight in the Hunter, which meant aeros, and then in the Buccaneer down low over the sea at 500 knots plus, and then through the hills, a toss bombing maneuver. I mean, it was kind of mind blowing stuff, which I will never ever forget. I consider myself incredibly lucky.
Wow.
Right. Well, that sounds like you're back for the next episode. Right.
Yeah,
okay.
I was going to say, stop now. Okay, let's move on. Story in defence news here. Germany reports moving towards a split buy of Super Hornets, Growlers and Eurofighter Typhoons to replace their Tornadoes. Bit of a cocktail there, isn't it?
I think probably it is. So this is the post Tornado force mix. You know, what are Germany going to buy for strike? And it's a tricky one, because if you're in the Luftwaffe and you suggest F-35, you immediately lose your job. that's sort of already happened. But they've got a curious requirement in that they, at the moment, unless it changes, they are part of a NATO agreement to carry US B-61 nuclear weapons. These were all are still deployed on sort of NATO air bases, Belgium, the Netherlands, Turkey, and Germany, in the event that the balloon went up and the Russians or ex-Soviets would get a bucket of sunshine from, you know, everybody in NATO. Now, you think of the anti-military feeling in Germany anyway. They're not really particularly keen on it, but they've got to replace Tornadoes. So Eurofighter is obviously saying get the more advanced version of the Eurofighter. It'll lead on to something called FCAS, but there's still this requirement for nuclear delivery, which is, I think, well, probably where this Super Hornet, buying Super Hornets, is. And the other thing that Super Hornet has been developed into is a seed electronic attack aircraft under the Growler, which also, that was also one of the missions for Germany's Tornado fleet, you know, ECRs. So they were the sort of nuclear delivery, you know, strike and electronic warfare. Electronic warfare's, you know, seed, you know, so anti-radar roles. So I think this is where this mix has come from, of a kind of a bizarre mini fleet within a mini fleet type kind of mixture. But it to my mind, it just looks as a real sort of like, when you're an air force like Germany and you're struggling with availability rates and you know, maintainability, and you know how many aircraft you can generate, splitting it down even further and buying a tiny fleet of Super Hornets and tiny fleet of Growlers, you know, maybe that's not maybe that's not going to make that the availability kind of conundrum go away.
Why can't the Typhoon be modified? Because in effect, that's what they're doing. Or is it because it's off the shelf? Big air quotes going here. Off the shelf, ready to roll aircraft in the Growler and the Super Hornet.
Off the shelf is one reason, but the other reason is you know, you've got a European aircraft, European fighter aircraft, and an American bomb. So therefore, even with the best will of the world, it's going to say, you know, probably take a little bit longer. And you've also got the immense political baggage going on top of it. You know, we're going to turn Eurofighter into a nuclear bomber, which would, you know, cause certain heads in the German political kind of establishment to explode in anger. So how would you get that past politically to we're going to develop this into a nuclear strike, into the nuclear strike role? So it's far easier, I think, from that point of view. And also, you've got it from the US side, you know, there's the unspoken, less sort of, you know, generous outlook of a US ally as well. You know, it's not really in their interests to integrate a US, you know, nuclear weapon on a European fighter. You know, they might just decide just to, you know, drag their feet a bit and, you know, hope that Germany buys a Hornet or a 35. You know, that would, they want to sell fighters, you know, so probably a bit of both there.
Okay, let's move on to Virgin and Virgin Orbit. Story in The Verge. Small satellite launcher, Virgin Orbit conducts dress rehearsal ahead of its first fleet test. Flew out of Mojave and they did a near-perfect test launch from all the reports. I didn't realise Virgin were this close, but that's really, really good news. That was on Sunday. That was the 12th of April. They're a bit closer to launch than we thought. Cosmic Girl, who of course is the converted 747, flew a perfect profile. Apparently they used water to simulate the Launcher 1, which is the rocket that they would be launching. So that's really good news for the industry. Isn't that planned to be able to fly from Cornwall, Tim?
That's one of the things that they're talking about. Yeah, you know, I mean, one of the big advantages for air launched rapid space access is, you know, you can deploy it anywhere, so you're not really kind of launched. You're not really kind of tied down to a launch site like, you know, Cape Canaveral. So they are talking about Cornwall. I think also Italy has been mentioned as well. You know, rapid sort of small satellites. And interestingly, there's an RAF test pilot who is now seconded to Virgin Orbit, who is, you know, his job, I think, is to basically pick up as much experience of these types of launches. And then, you know, there's a couple of ways why that might be interesting for the military. One is, you know, somebody takes your satellites out, you need to replace them quickly. Well, if you've got a 747 that can drop, you know, small satellites and launch them quickly, that takes care of that. And the other one is the growing interest in hypersonics. So the US has got a, you know, they want to go and test a hypersonic projectile, hypersonic missile. They can easily kind of, you know, going well, easily, but they can, they've got a B-50, they've got B-52s there. They can go and hang them off and go and test them over you know, Mojave and fire them out of the Pacific, etc. Having that kind of capability for the UK, all of a sudden, you put that together with something maybe like sort of Skylon, and then, you know, the Sabre engine, and you think, oh, hang on, that's a way in which, you know, you could test a subscale demonstrator for something hypersonic, couldn't you? You know, and so I don't know, just ideas here, but it's got a lot of applications.
Yeah, I mean, it's one which really caught my eye. I mean, it was fantastic to see Cosmic Girl flying the sort of profile that we're used to seeing, you know, things like NASA's Vomit Comet flying, sort of soaring skyward. But it's, the RAF connection really intrigued me as well. I believe that there's a joint program, you know, how limited it is in its extent, I'm not sure, between the Defence Science Technology Laboratory in this country and the US Air Force Aerospace Laboratory to explore hypersonics. And the launcher, the sort of putative launcher they've come up with, looks almost identical to Cosmic Girl. I think there was a hard point, isn't there, inside of the inner engine, which was designed to carry a spare, it's there to carry a spare engine should it be needed to be moved from one location to another on a 747. So the machine has this sort of hard point built into it, which means it's sort of useful for hanging 17,000 kilogram missiles underneath. But the Virgin operation, I was lucky enough to go out there to Mojave and see around it, is fantastic and has a very strong sort of British connection in the form of Dave Mackay, who's their chief pilot and is a British test pilot, former Harrier pilot, who got the flying bug when he was living in Scotland near what was then Royal Naval Air Station, Lossiemouth, seeing the Buccaneers flying over. And Dave, after leaving the Air Force, joined Virgin in the hope that it might offer, he'd always wanted to be an astronaut ever since reading the Lady Bird book of exploring space, in the hope that something interesting might come of it. And, you know, look what happened. Ended up being seconded by Alex Tye into the Virgin Galactic operation. And, I met him. He was there at Mojave and we flew in the Spaceship Two simulator and had a look around the launcher one as well. I mean, it was an amazing trip, but he feels to me a little bit, Dave Mackay, with that RAF background, the sort of Harrier pilot background, as a sort of and having flown into space, of course, last year for the very first time in Spaceship Two, during which flight he carried that copy of the Lady Bird book of exploring space in his flight suit. Feels a little bit like the real Dan Dare, you know, the guy who the Brit who flew himself into space with a stick and rudder rather than sitting in a capsule on top of a rocket, like Helen Sharman and Tim Peake. So I've been really fascinated by Dave Mackay's story, and also now that of Matthew Stannard as well, Flight Lieutenant Matthew Stannard, who's gone from Typhoons to 747s at Virgin Orbit.
There is another connection, actually, between Brits in hypersonic vehicles and, a former guest, actually, on Extended, potential hypersonic vehicles. And I noticed you were Roland, you were tweeting about an idea for a piloted British Blue Steel missile that Captain Winkle Brown had turned down because it was too insane even for him.
Yeah, well, that was a really funny, he got the giggles quite a lot through that conversation. One time when he was talking about Pancho Barnes, the sort of the friend of Chuck Yeager's, who ran the ranch at Edwards. But another time was when I asked him about and I think she showed him pictures of this sort of Man Blue Steel design, because Winkle, of course, had been invited to join the X-15 program, he was a great friend of Scott Crossfield's, who was the North American test pilot who flew the early X-15 missions before it was handed over to the Air Force and NASA. His application was seconded or seconded rather, by Neil Armstrong, who was also part of the program, who had been a great admirer of Winkle's career as a test pilot before he became a test pilot himself. So I hadn't known about Winkle's near association with the X-15 until I spoke to him that time, with a view to, I mean, I was talking this whole sort of Dave Mackay, Winkle Brown, actually Nigel Wood as well, is also somebody I've talked to, the RAF Lightning pilot who was going to fly on the shuttle before the Challenger disaster as part of the Skynet program, is with a sort of thought somehow tying it in together as a story of sort of Britain's long flirtation with, but ultimately sort of disappointing relationship with manned spaceflight. But in people like Helen Sharman, Tim Peake, but particularly Dave Mackay, we've got people who can certainly be sort of cast in that role of finally sort of succeeding in putting Brits in space, even if it's not quite how Eagle Comic imagined it in the late 1950s.
Fascinating stuff. Thanks for that, chaps. And then finally, let's sign off with a story that Roland brought to our attention, and that's Art Knowles. He's selling his Harrier fleet. Actually, interestingly enough, I didn't know he had a fleet, but he's got a T-8 as well that he's just about finished restoring. But of course, it is his main Harrier, X-Ray Zulu 439, that we all know from the air show circuit in the States. Are we likely to see someone buy this and continue that good work, do you think, Roland?
God, I mean, I really hope so. I mean, I suppose the challenge there is with finding a pilot who is deemed to be sufficiently capable of flying it. Because, you know, Art Knowles was a former US Marine Corps Harrier pilot. You know, it's all very well buying it, but the Federal Aviation Authority will not let anyone just step into the cockpit of a Sea Harrier and fly it. Because they're all deemed sort of warbirds, largely I think they're classified as experimental aircraft once they're in civilian hands. There are quite stringent restrictions on who can and can't fly them. So they're going to have to find somebody who, at the very least, is a former military pilot with a lot of hours. But they're going to have to find somebody who can teach them how to fly a Harrier as well. And you know, that's going to be an ever decreasing number of people, I suppose, now with the F-35 beginning to replace the, or maybe an increasing number actually, F-35 beginning to replace the Harriers in U.S. Marine Corps service. But I can't imagine it can be anyone but a former Harrier pilot who, even if somebody else has bought it, is going to end up flying it. You know, fingers crossed. I mean, it'd be fantastic to see that continue to fly, as it would be fantastic to see the effort to get a Sea Harrier airworthy again and on the air show circuit here in the UK.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah, I mean, it's real. I think that, you know, the conversations with the CAA are ongoing, but it's you know, it's got proper substantial financial backing, you know, it remains, I think, an ongoing conversation with the CIA. But yeah, it would be just fantastic to see a Harrier flying again. I could sort of live with seeing 558 on the ground if we saw a Harrier flying again.
Yeah, here. Well, listen, let's take a quick break, and we're going to come back after the break and talk about Harrier 809.
This is Extended, the ETOPS Aviation Podcast.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. We will bring you multimedia, lectures and discussion from inside the world of aviation, aeronautics and space. If you enjoy our content, please consider showing your support for the Society. If you have an interest in aerospace, find out about the professional and personal benefits that Society membership offers. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
G'day, I'm Dave Homewood of the Wings Over New Zealand show, New Zealand's only regular aviation podcast series. The Wings Over New Zealand show covers all sorts of aviation topics, with a New Zealand flavour but an international appeal. From interviews with veterans and aviation personalities, to topics like military aviation, warbirds, air shows, historians, authors, museums, aviation events, and much, much more. We have an extensive archive of episodes that you can go back to, and there are new episodes coming out all the time. Search for the Wings Over New Zealand show. Oh, and by the way, we love Extended. It's a great show. Well done, guys.
We've invited Roland on this episode to discuss his latest book, Harrier 809. And what a read it is. It's already attracting, among the people I follow on Twitter, already attracting rave reviews from people who have been lucky enough to get an advanced copy. Chock full of things about, obviously, Sea Harriers, but also about Canberras, the whole Falklands War, UK involvement, converting a container ship into a mini carrier. It really is an avgeek's dream read. So, I mean, to kick off, Roland, why Harriers? Why the Falklands? You know, I mean, we've already had, you know, it seems to be sort of plenty of stuff on Harriers, you know, Sharky Ward and things like that. Why did you choose Harriers in the first place?
I mean, I think my interest is sort of pretty deep rooted. You know, I grew up in the 70s and 80s. I was an 11-year-old schoolboy in 1982 who had Richard Cook posters bought from the back of Flypast magazine on his wall of GR3 shooting Sneb rockets, and had watched sort of Raymond Baxter rhapsodize about Harriers at Farnborough during the sort of the television programs that would follow that as of every year. And so when we found ourselves at war in 1982, and this sort of air show novelty that had been often quite savagely dismissed as being incapable of carrying a matchbox across a playing field was the aeroplane upon which success or failure was dependent. Took place. It caught my eye. It was never going to fail to be something that had me pouring through the newspapers every single day. I mean, I don't think I had ever really taken as much interest in the daily news stories as I did then. You know, I mean, we grew up with sort of Commando comic and Warlord comic and, you know, Where Eagles Dare and all the sort of Sunday afternoon war movies and things. And here it was, in my sort of 11-year-old mind, being played out for real. You know, every day we'd get Ian MacDonald, the MOD spokesman, announcing the various developments in the war, whether it had been the sinking of a ship or the loss of an aircraft or the bombing of Port Stanley Airfield. And it was all unfolding in real time. But the language was exactly as we'd all sort of been brought up to sort of appreciate and follow. And it was obviously exclusive. Well, as I discovered doing this book, less exclusively British than perhaps I had imagined. But certainly the fighting on the ground, the fighting in the air, fighting at sea, was an exclusively British affair, and as a result, even more gripping to my 11-year-old imagination.
I mean, the interesting thing about that is it was, you know, the Harrier at that time was really underrated, wasn't it? You've got a bit in the book about the, you know, the defence analysis to turns up from, you know, MOD and basically says, tells the Harrier pilots you're all going to die. and it's you know, we've done our studies, we've done our modelling, we've done our simulations, and you know, you guys haven't got a chance, and it's so swiftly escorted off the premises.
I mean, there was Sharky Ward on Invincible was being told a similar thing by JJ Black, the captain who would receive all the reports from Northwood, really, in answer to your first question, why the Harrier? Why 809? Well, Dave Morgan wrote about 800 Squadron. Sharky Ward wrote about 801, which were the two frontline squadrons at the time. And because of the anticipated losses, both through combat attrition, but also the maintenance challenges that came from fighting a war 8,000 miles from home, in what were often appalling conditions, there was expected to be a desperate need for reinforcements. And so Harriers were pulled out of attrition reserve at St. Athan. They were pulled out of the training squadron 899. They were taken from Boscombe Down and from Farnborough, and also actually from Kingston, where John Farley was testing them. And dragged to Yeovilton in order to form a new squadron. And Tim Gedge, who'd previously been boss of the first boss of 800 Squadron as a Harrier Squadron, first Sea Harrier Squadron, or frontline Sea Harrier Squadron, asked to come back from his day job and form a new squadron. And they managed to scrape together eight jets. They scraped pilots together from Arizona, from Australia, from Germany, from California, brought them all back to Yeovilton, gave them a little less than 3 weeks training, sent them off to war aboard Atlantic Conveyor. And so that whole sort of Dirty Dozen feel to it, you know, we're going to, as one of the Fleet Air Arm observers I was talking to you said, you know, the only person we didn't have was somebody out of prison. Dirty Dozen feel to it, you know, bring them all together, get them to Yeovilton, give them whatever training you can. And the two RAF Harrier pilots, John Leeming and Steve Brown, who were a week after the squadron was reformed, brought over from Germany, 3F Squadron, and put into the cockpit of a Sea Harrier for the first time, had less than 10 hours flying time in a Sea Harrier before they were pitched into war over the Falklands. And admittedly, they had flown Lightning, so they had some air defense experience. But, you know, 10 hours isn't a great deal of time to get to grips with a machine which, while it might look sort of broadly similar to a GR3, is quite obviously a completely different airplane once you're sitting in the cockpit with its radar, different cockpit layout, different avionics, none of which they're familiar with at all. So it felt to me always as if this 809 story, which was always sort of always kind of mentioned in passing, I suppose, next to 800 and 801 story, was in some ways the most remarkable, most interesting of the lot. And I also, and this is just a personal opinion, felt that their light gray paint job, which was developed by a scientist at Farnborough called Phil Barley, using Airfix models and photometers on the roof of the flat roof of the aviation medicine department at Farnborough, looked much cooler than the dark of the Sea Harriers. I just thought it looked good. They had the sort of the pastel roundels and the 809 Phoenix on the tail. They looked great. That can never be underestimated, I don't think.
Roland, Commander Tim Gedge, who was we were lucky enough to have a brief chat with him. What a very, very nice gent he is. He's a bit of an unsung hero, really, isn't he? Because you mentioned two other superstars in the, for want of a better description earlier, but Commander Gedge doesn't get quite the airing that Sharky and Dave Morgan did.
No, I think that's right. And it's one of the things which has been it's given me enormous pleasure in sort of bringing this story to life is I think producing a book which I hope will ensure that Tim gets the credit he deserves. I mean, the Navy were in no doubt at all about the fact that he deserved a good deal of credit for pulling 809 together again at such short notice. He had been, as I say, the very first frontline squadron boss of a Sea Harrier squadron when 800 returned. So he'd pioneered a lot of the, particularly the getting to grips with the weapon system, air to ground particularly. I had gone to work at for Flag Officer Flotilla 3 carriers and amphibious ships at Fort Southwark, and had to watch his squadron. This was just in January, about sort of 2 or 3 months before the war kicked off. Kept his hand in flying hunters, but he had to watch his squadron go off to war, and saw them sailing from Fort Southwark, saw the two carriers sailing out of Portsmouth. It was, later that day he was asked to return to Yeovilton and put together a new squadron. But as I say, the Navy were in no doubt at all about the scale of his achievements in pulling together a brand new frontline squadron in just 3 weeks and taking it to war, when they awarded him later in the year the Boyd Trophy, which is given annually to the member of the Fleet Air Arm, or members of the Fleet Air Arm, who are reckoned to have made the greatest contribution to naval aviation in a given year. And so in 1982, as you can imagine, there were a good many contenders for the Boyd Trophy, but they gave it to Tim Gedge, who actually later, after the war, took 809 back to the Falklands to defend the islands until the arrival of 29 Squadron's Phantoms once the runway had been extended. So they, after fighting in the war, he led 809 back to the Falklands aboard HMS Illustrious, this time with the airborne early warning Sea Kings that had been sort of hurriedly developed, and from aboard Illustrious and from Stanley reinforced with RAF Harriers, who were all staying there on the airfield, they maintained the QRA at Stanley until the Phantoms arrived.
Fascinating story. I mean, one of the things that also strikes me about Harrier 809 is it's not just about Harriers, though. I mean, every few pages you're picking up going, "Oh, I didn't know that. Oh, that's interesting. I've never heard that before." I mean, I'm not going to spoil it for readers or potential readers who obviously may be wanting to buy it in the future. But there's some really interesting stuff about secret Canberra operations and Nimrod ops I'd never heard before, and some kind of again, Biggles Boyzone type plan to land a Canberra on the Trans-American Highway at night and refuel it. Yeah. You describe it someone that sounds like complete craziness.
Oh yeah, they were going to likely put ferry flares down Pan-American Highway, put ferry flares down the road to mark out the glide path. But it was, I hadn't planned to do it like that at all. I'd imagined it was going to be quite a sort of short, sharp, focused book on 809 Squadron, which didn't kind of stray far from that path. But as soon as I got going on it, I realized that nobody had really written about the Falklands Air War since the records had been declassified in 30 years after the war, so 2012. And of course, being the kind of obsessive that I am, I had to go through them and see what I could find. It was sort of panning for gold, and I kept finding very, very brief, sometimes oblique references to operations like Op Acme, Op Fingent, Op Folklore, and these were never expanded on. Fingent actually has been the file on that's been released, but Folklore and Acme, no. So these were two top secret reconnaissance operations designed to be flown out of Chile. ACME was the Nimrod R1 operation and Folklore the Canberra PR9 operation. So I'd look through files like one detailing modifications to airplanes, and you see, oh, look, we've got the Hercules refueling, we've seen the revival of the Vulcan's refueling capability, refueling on the Nimrod, sidewinders on the Nimrod, shrikes on the Vulcans. And in that long list of various sort of modifications, innovations that had been made to the airplanes, there was a reference to an extra fuel tank put on a Canberra PR9 chaff and flare dispensers and jamming pods on a Canberra PR9. I thought, well, that's interesting. I hadn't known the cameras had been down to the Falklands or been modified to take part in operations. So as soon as you found that thread, op folklore, and there's a sort of chunk not expanded on in the 39 squadron record book, which just says two airplanes and three crews were involved in Operation Folklore between April 6th and whatever the date was now. I think it was April the 17th. And didn't expand on it at all. You then thought, well, I know this, I know this, I know this. And what the people going through the archives, the people vetting the archives don't realize is that there's a sort of a trail of crumbs that if you read through everything, you can kind of put together and assemble something that, while it might not quite look like a loaf of bread, looks like a big pile of crumbs. You can sort of build a very, very convincing circumstantial case, which you are sufficiently confident in to say this is what happened. You then have to share it with people who were involved. And I was very, very lucky to talk to the former boss of 39 Squadron, Canberra Squadron, Colin Adams, who was very kindly looked through what I'd got, answered my question, said, yeah, you've got this right. The plan was to fly the PR9s from Belize across Central America, down onto the Pan American Highway, to fly out over the South Atlantic, really map the whole of the Falklands, but also use them to try to locate the Argentinian Navy ships as well, because that reconnaissance was very hard to come by, and it was a problem throughout the war. And the Nimrod R1s as well were dragnetting for information on the signals intelligence front as well, radar reconnaissance, communication intelligence, electronic intelligence, and they had a few hairy moments as well, and not least an engine failure, which led to some emergency landing on an island in the South Pacific, and eventually the Chileans got cold feet about it all, and it meant that the Hercules supporting the that was in Chile to support the Canberra was thrown out of the country at very short notice, landed in Tahiti without diplomatic clearance, and so the two Hercules actually were impounded by a French admiral in Tahiti until diplomatic clearance came through. And I suppose there's sort of worse ways of fighting a war than being stuck on Tahiti. But I didn't know any of this had happened, but I was able to sort of put it all together from often tiny little fragments in very, very disparate, diverse selections of files, sort of feel like I finally, at the end of it, got to the bottom of it all. It's all in the book, but it means that you've got this, the book turned into, from being this quite focused account of 809's war, into the wider story of the critical effort that there was, not just using Sea Harriers and Sea Darts and Sea Wolf missiles at sea, but by the RAF on mainland South America, but also back at home within the sort of military industrial complex of Farnborough, British Aerospace, Kingston, Boscombe Down, the Royal Radar Research Establishment, and many other organizations. And also the RAF kind of almost established a sort of pipeline to provide reinforcement harriers should they be needed. There's this sort of incredible broad effort at home in South America, at sea, in the air, to protect those two critical carriers from air attack, because had one of those been lost, it would have been game over. But so the book became about the effort to protect the carriers, and obviously Atlantic Conveyor taking 809 down was a key part of that story, and because she was the ship that took 809 to war alongside the six RAF GR3s from 1F Squadron, I hope I've been able to sort of bring her story to life and really do the story of her that ship and her crew and her master, Ian North, who lost his life along with 11 others, do that story justice, because you know, Conveyor's story is a remarkable one, really remarkable one.
I mean that's a really sort of like eye opener as well, as to you know, Atlantic Conveyor, it tends to sort of get discounted as well as to you know, in obviously attacked, sunk, and the rest of it, but the idea of having it as almost like a cam ship with a Harrier on standby to you know, launch the alert fighter vertically.
Yeah. Oh, I love that.
And then go and shoot down a you know, you've got what's 100 miles or something. They reckon they could get out of it.
Tim, I think this figure's etched into Tim's mind. He says it's 183 miles that they could take off vertically. They could intercept one of the Argentine 707s that was shadowing the fleet at a distance of 183 miles, on paper at least, make it back to Conveyor. I think he and his senior pilot Dave Braithwaite, both of them were former 892 Phantom pilots, and Dave had been dragged back from California, where he was flying for VX4, the US Navy's test and evaluation squadron, flying Tomcats and Phantoms and things back into the Sea Harrier. The two of them, I'm not sure, were entirely convinced that if they had launched, they'd have got back onto Conveyor. But the RAF were launching something, it was Operation Grammarian, launching Victors from Ascension to provide some kind of a backup for certainly the earlier period when that Sea Harrier was kept on the pad on alert. But yeah, like you said, Tim, it reminded me enormously of the whole cam ship story and launching Hurricanes off merchant ships in the Second World War, which is when I discovered that the first Condor that was shot down by one of those catapult fighters was flown by an Australian Royal Navy Volunteer Reserve pilot called Bob Everett, who's a previous Grand National winner. And he reckoned that shooting down the Condor was even more exciting than winning the Grand National. And I have to take his word for it.
Event Fire Solutions is an independent fire and rescue service providing both preventative and reactive emergency services across the UK. As well as our main event management, we provide the support and equipment to deliver a safe and risk-free event. From fire appliances to medical vehicles, our fully trained and accredited staff will make your event a true success. If you need risk-related advice, investigation, medical or fire training, then we can deliver this for you. From the office to the airfield, we have the experience and the accreditation and most of all the skills to make your workplace event safe and risk-free. To find out more of how we can help you, look us up at eventfiresolutions.co.uk.
you've got some interesting detail in there from the Argentinian side too. I mean, you know, showing how they were training. You know, they were sort of struggling to put together their attack forces. Mm. They had a limited number of sort of exocet rounds. You know, bad weather and things like that. And then you know the bizarre thing that there was a couple of. One ex RAF Pathfinder chap from the World War II who was flying a Learjet looking for the task force.
Yeah, there were two former Royal Air Force Bomber Command pilots who they were Anglo-Argentinian and went back to Argentina after the war. But they volunteered to fly for something called Esquadron Phoenix or Phoenix, Spanish not strong point, I'm afraid, which was a paramilitary unit set up to fly business jets in support of the Argentinian fast jet force. So sometimes they'd act as radio relays, sometimes they would act as decoys to try and drag the Sea Harrier cap away from where the Daggers and Skyhawks would be coming in. But two of them, were former RAF pilots, which was sort of interesting detail that again I stumbled on doing this. I mean, one of the things which enabled me to write the book I ended up writing, and I could never have done it 10 years ago, was Google Translate, simply because, as you might imagine, there's an enormous number of newspaper interviews with Argentinian veterans, which now, like all newspapers, are available online. And so by finding the interviews with the pilots who I knew from reading books like Jeffrey Ethel and Alfred Price's fantastic Air War South Atlantic or the Falklands, the Air War sort of Bible. If I could find the names and the units of pilots, I could often then find an Argentinian newspaper or magazine interview with them, which I could then translate using Google Translate. If I sort of knew enough about the story in advance, Google Translate, although it can be a sort of fairly blunt tool, was good enough for me to get the sense of what they were saying and be able to then translate it into proper idiomatic English rather than a sort of terrible literal translation of what they'd said in their interview. So a lot of the details, there's some wonderful detail in there about particularly one of the Argentinian pilots who got Skyhawk pilots who got shot down, and how he survived by sort of killing and skinning and roasting a lamb while he was sort of on escape and evasion Falkland Islands. So wonderful detail there came from these Argentinian newspaper reports. But again, that wouldn't have been available to a previous generation of researchers. I think a lot of it hadn't actually been written, but even if they wouldn't have been able to find it online, and unless they spoke Spanish, it wouldn't have meant anything to them without an app like Google Translate. So there was all sorts of things that which helped me write the book that became as sort of rich and substantial as it sort of ended up becoming, and you know, much to my surprise as well. But once I knew that stuff, I had to find a way of including it, and it was all about this the sort of battle between Argentina's need to take out one of the carriers and Britain's need to defend those carriers from attack with all means at her disposal. And that, I mean, you know, one of those one point that was considered was the airship that people will remember from that James Bond movie, A View to a Kill. Department of Naval Air Warfare even explored the idea of using Skyship 500 as something that could carry an airborne early warning radar.
Wow. So you know, research and the fact you couldn't do it sort of 10 years ago, that was really interesting. What I mean, you've got a few books under your belt now. So was this an easier write than Vulcan 607? How long did it take you to write, you know?
I thought it would never end. I had anticipated finishing the book in February, and I finished it in May. But I have a full time job, and so, you know, it meant getting up at 5 a.m. and literally working all day, both days of the weekend, from about December through till May. I was on my knees by the end of it. It wasn't that I wasn't enjoying the material. It was a long haul. I'd expected to write a 75,000 word book, and I ended up writing a 140,000 word book. I felt that I was including all of the bits in that story that I needed to include. You know, they're all just too good to leave out.
Yeah.
So it did. It took much longer than I'd thought it was going to take. And I knew I was uncovering some fabulous and fresh detail, even to people who I think were familiar or are familiar with the most well-known aspects of the war. But so the challenge then was to try to bring all of that fresh detail to life in a book that felt as if it was telling a single story, that felt as if it really had a sort of cohesion to it and read like a thriller. I mean, I've always said that things like Hunt for Red October or Red Storm Rising are the kind of touchstones for me. It's trying to harness and manage all of that material in a way, spin all of those plates in a way that ensures readers never kind of feel as if they're wading through treacle. I want people to be sort of turning those pages as quickly as they can, as if they were reading a James Patterson, Tom Clancy, Frederick Forsyth thriller.
Yeah, I mean, did you find writing it, did it change your opinion of the Falklands War and Harrier's role? Did you come away thinking, ooh, actually, that was more of a close run thing than you know most people realise, and that there's a lot of you know, there are a few incidents. I'm thinking, you know, maybe one of the times where there was, you know, no wind for the Argentinian carrier to launch, and you think, oh, that could have easily gone the other way.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely changed my view. What it did was increase my sort of understanding and appreciation of what really matters in an air war, I suppose. And I realized that often the sort of top trumps numbers on sort of top speed, altitude, acceleration things aren't the be all and end all. And one of the things that I sort of got to grips with was the work done by John Boyd on energy maneuverability, and the importance that he attached not just to sort of top speed and to maximum altitude, but to the speed with which an aeroplane can recover lost energy alongside its instantaneous ability to change direction. And it just so happens, more by accident by design than by design. Well, by design, but only insofar as it was a corollary of what was required to allow, ensure a jet fighter could take off vertically. The Sea Harrier had these qualities in spades. You know, it had a much higher thrust to weight ratio than sort of any other Allied fighter, other than something like an F-15 or an F-16, both of which John Boyd was instrumental in the way they turned out. And it also had this sort of ferocious acceleration up to about sort of 20,000 feet. So while it was not supersonic, most air wars, certainly at low level, are not fought at supersonic speeds. You know, below 20,000 feet, it was, every bit the match of the Mirages and certainly the Skyhawks. I mean, there's quotes from the US Marine Corps pilots who had been the first to really explore the Harrier's potential in air-to-air combat. And they flew it against, you know, everything in the US arsenal. The Marine Corps would say, you know, there's not an aeroplane in the world that can stay behind a Harrier, and Harrier pilot doesn't want it to. And during trials conducted by the US Marine Corps, they discovered that a clean AV-8A Harrier was capable of climbing to 30,000 feet 13 seconds faster than a clean F-4 Phantom. Of course, you know, the F-4 Phantom was the aeroplane that had held all those time to climb records, flown by John Young, who I wrote about in Into the Black, who was first shuttle astronaut. The F-4 Phantom had held all those time to climb records until MiG-25s and Streak Eagles took them back in the 70s. And so for the Harrier to be that much faster to 30,000 feet gives you an idea of just how capable a flying machine it really was, and how lazy the criticism as a warplane often was.
The other thing that sort of strikes me in Harrier 809 and what the book sort of deals with is you know that the Harrier clique, and it's a bit of a cliche, but they are a kind of elite within an elite, and you know, but even within that kind of small niche of people who do, you know, single seat VSTOL, single seat, single engine, you know, there's some divisions within the Harrier tribe, isn't there? So that, you know, you've got 809, you've got Invincible Hermes, you've got the RAF GR3s who join almost with their own personalities. Can you kind of quickly sort of sum them up as to, you know, if you were going to sort of like the sort of personalities of the squadrons?
Yeah, I mean, a little, I suppose. I mean, you know, certainly, you know, the Fleet Air Arm had something, I suppose, of a sort of siege mentality. You know, it had got smaller and smaller and smaller throughout the 50s and 60s, and 1966, obviously, CVA-01, the new generation cats and traps carrier was cancelled. So they had these three Harrier carriers and a small fleet of Sea Harriers. I mean, you know, there were only 20 Sea Harriers they could scrape together to go to the South Atlantic aboard Invincible and Hermes initially, and that was by reinforcing what were normally only five aircraft strong squadrons in 800 and 801. I mean, 801's first boss, this was the second Sea Harrier squadron to form, was run by Sharkey Ward, who's, I'm sure, well known to almost every extended reader. You know, big personality, you know, much loved by the 801 pilots, and clearly enjoyed a great relationship with J.J. Black, the captain, and was on board a carrier that didn't have to absorb the quite the same number of aircraft that Andy Old's squadron on board Hermes had to absorb, didn't have to absorb an entirely different kind of Harrier in the form of the GR3s from the RAF. So was able to sort of run the squadron sort of much more along the lines, I think, that he wanted to, without being at the mercy to the same extent of demands made on him by the captain and also by the admiral. So poor old Andy Old, who's running 800 squadron, first of all, had a much bigger and sort of more complex arrangement he had to kind of stay on top of. And he always had Hermes captain Lynn Middleton, who was, unlike J.J. Black, a former naval aviator and had a very strong opinion about things, and also Sandy Woodward on Hermes as well. So he had less room for maneuver, I suppose, Andy Auld. I think that's probably the easiest way to categorize the difference between the outlook between the two squadrons. Yeah. And 809, once it got down south, was sort of absorbed split between Hermes and Invincible, and sort of absorbed into the two existing squadrons. So it sort of ceased to have a proper identity of its own, except through kind of small acts of rebellion, I suppose. And then the one other more obvious difference, I suppose, is Invincible was largely charged with it was the lead carrier for air defense, while Hermes, particularly once it was carrying the GR3s as well, tended to take the lead for ground attack. I mean, that wasn't exclusive, or both had a responsibility for both aspects of the fighting, but the certainly Invincible did take a lead on the air defense.
And talking of sort of Sharky Ward, we've had him on the show. He's got strong views about lots of things, and he's got strong views about F-35, obviously the successor to the Harrier, the supersonic, a supersonic stealth Harrier, if you like, in the form of the B version. Do you think today the UK could mount this sort of operation? You know, say a former scratch F-35B squadron, stick them on a container ship, send them into harm's way?
Can't imagine it happening. No, I mean, I simply can't see that. I can't see it happening. That's not really a commentary on the F-35 alone. I mean, I think you'd find as much difficulty probably throwing people into the cockpit of a Typhoon, expecting them to go to war 10 days later. I mean, because I would imagine that the flying of an F-35 or a Typhoon is going to be relatively familiar to anyone who's flown a fast jet, but the systems have become, and the avionics becomes so much more critical to the way that a war is fought now, that we were fortunate in a way that in many respects, and certainly from the point of view of 1F squadron, their GR3s, they were having to fight using Second World War technology. I mean, they had fixed gun sights and nothing else, the GR3s, because they couldn't get their inertial navigation system sort of up and running on a moving deck, and then that was something that was never sorted out. So I mean, they were flying using pre Second World War technology, and now that's something. I mean, interestingly, that is something that RAF F-35 pilots still trained to be able to do is dead reckoning. In the course of interviewing for this book, I've spoken on a number of occasions to John Butcher, who until very recently was boss of 617 Squadron, the first British F-35 unit. And that's one of the things that he explained and said was very different characteristic between the way the RAF trains its pilots and the way that the US Air Force trains its pilots, is that RAF pilots are still taught how to navigate and how to navigate by dead reckoning with a stopwatch and a pen and a pencil. Others who I spoke to sort of talked about how, particularly when they were on exchange with the American squadrons, they would do everything they could to try to persuade their American counterparts to train for when things went wrong, in peacetime training this is, rather than always try to score 100% in whatever task was set them. Because if they were scoring 100%, it meant that they weren't testing themselves. It meant they looked good on paper, but they weren't preparing themselves for when everything started to unravel.
Okay. Well, coming to a final three questions now. So, what was the favourite thing you found out? I mean, as I say, it's an absolute dream for anyone interested in Falklands, aviation, Harriers. What was the favourite thing that you found out while writing it that made you smile?
Well, I mean, I really love the idea of the Farnborough employing professional model makers to build 1-24 scale Airfix kits of Harrier GR1s, which were then sort of sprayed in different kinds of camouflage in order to sort of test whether or not they were effective. Once the prospect of sort of painting full scale hunters became too expensive. One I really, really loved was the discovery that, and this came about, it was when 809 were working up back at Yeovilton and training for radar and ground control radar intercepts. The guys on the ground, the fighter controllers on the ground, realized that some of the Sea Harriers that they were pulling in from various different sources were just showing up a whole lot bigger on radar, the big blips rather than small blips. And they just couldn't figure out why some of the Sea Harriers seemed to be so much bigger until they realized that it was all to do with the amount of WD-40 they'd had sprayed on them. So the Sea Harriers' radar signature is dramatically altered by the amount of WD-40 that they sprayed. So it seemed that they were faced with they had a choice between getting shot down or corroding. I think that surely shows that.
That's a tip there for the F-35, current F-35 fleet and F-35 operators there. They're right there. So don't put WD-40 on your F-35s, no matter how squeaky they get. The book ends on a little teaser, Roland. Should Tornado fans be getting excited right now?
Yeah. No, this is I've got to stop procrastinating now, and I've really got to get stuck into the next book. And actually, I mean, one of the things we haven't talked about is the fact that the book, which we had originally looked forward to publishing on April the 30th, the day before the anniversary of the outbreak of the war on May 1st, has had to be pushed back to October because of the current coronavirus pandemic. It's just with so many bookshops closed, and no ability to sort of get around and promote the book, even though people are able to order from, you know, independent bookshops and Waterstones and Amazon, of course, as well online. We were just going to be cut off at the knees by that. So it's now going to be published in the middle of October. There are one or two tasters that people can find before that. There's a big piece about Canberra operation that I wrote for Aeroplane Monthly, which was published last week, and you can buy that at if you can't get to WH Smith's off Key Publishing's website. And there's a Q&A appearing in Aviation News as well about Harrier 809. So there's sort of bits and pieces, and I'll keep tweeting about it as well. That will be appearing between now and October, but to sort of slightly misquote Tom Cruise, you've waited a long time. I know some of you have waited a long time. Well, you're going to have to wait a little longer. Harrier 809 takes to the air in October, so you're still getting it 2 months before you get Top Gun Maverick. I'm pleased to say, but yes, it means that. I've got to stop procrastinating and start working hard on the next book. So I got into 809, or the sort of trigger for 809. We talked about how much I was fascinated by the story, but the trigger for it was realizing that the second British F-35 squadron was going to be 809 Naval Air Squadron. But the first, of course, was 617. So I realized that potentially there was a way of dovetailing 809's story with a 617 story. And as it happened, I'd had my eye on one for a long time. And that's the story in 1984 of when 617 Squadron, which was really only a year into its career as a Tornado Squadron, it was the second RAF Tornado Squadron. So sort of fresh out of the box, very, very new airplane. RAF had finally got itself something, properly state of the art in terms of its kind of low level strike capability. Were asked by the chief of the air staff, David Craig, if they could take part, or not asked, they were told they were going to be taking part in Giant Voice, which is the US Air Force Strategic Air Command's bombing competition. And the RAF had competed, and sometimes very successfully, in the sort of 60s and 70s, using Vulcans. But had simply not been competitive by 1980, which was the last time that they took part, when actually it was 617 again flying Vulcans. The Vulcan was definitely outclassed then by the F-111s, by the B-52s, which had been upgraded. But in 1984, the Tornadoes were sent out to sort of take part against the B-52s, FB-111s, F-111s from US Air Force Europe and Australian F-111Cs as well. They were sort of quite loudly dismissed as contenders by somebody very senior, the Air Force hierarchy at the Pentagon, who said Tornado is just no good. They haven't got a chance. But 617 had sort of done their homework, and they'd prepared well, and they won every single part of the competition that they were eligible for. And then they just sort of wiped the board. And so they had a huge celebration at the end of this Strategic Air Command bombing competition. But it then transpired that the techniques that they pioneered then were going to prove critical a few years later when Iraq invaded Kuwait. And obviously, you'll remember in the first few days of the war, the Tornadoes, British Tornadoes, took a terrible hammering in terms of the numbers getting shot down, mounting low-level attacks against strategic targets, largely the Iraqi, very heavily defended Iraqi air bases. Once air superiority had been sort of more properly established, there was an opportunity for Tornado Force to consider medium-level tactics and protect themselves from the sort of fierce anti-aircraft artillery down at low level. But the Tornado wasn't sort of set up for medium level bombing, and the crews hadn't trained for medium level bombing, and they had no precision bombing capability at all. And so the call went out to those who'd taken part in 1984 in Giant Voice, those who pioneered those medium level bombing techniques, to come and advise on that. And then the new precision bombing capability using the TL pod was again hurriedly pressed into service using two prototype pods under the as a responsibility of Bob Iverson. Right. Who in 1982 had been a Harrier pilot, but in 1991 was boss of 617 Squadron. So you've got Bob Iverson is in the first book, flying Harrier, and we talk about him getting shot down in support of the Paras at Goose Green. And he's also ends up being kind of a central figure in the second book, when he leads successfully leads the introduction of the Tornado's precision bombing capability in Gulf War One, based on some of the mission profiles that had been developed by 617 Squadron again in 1984 in that Giant Voice competition. So that, like the 809 story, sort of finishes in the year 2020-2021 at RAF Marham and the introduction of F-35. So all roads lead to F-35 with this in a sort of little little epilogue.
Wow.
So that it's always sort of hoped that it was going to be this sort of collection of loosely related books, but I sort of feel like I might have set myself up for something equally ambitious with the Tornado. But I'm really, really excited about doing it. I mean, you know, you can't beat the idea of a tornado flying past the kind of landscape that we that was made famous in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, which of course is exactly what they did.
That's another one to look out for then, folks. 809 Harris 617. Put that on your Christmas list now.
Dambuster 617, I think.
Dambuster 617. Yes. And so you've already taken my final question, which was you know, when does Harrier 809 come out? We've got to wait a little bit longer. So I'm going to finish off with a question maybe for those who are stuck at home and they want to buy a new T-shirt to wear on their Zoom meetings. I believe there's a purveyor of very fine aviation themed T-shirts, Roland. Who's got some new designs out? Project cancelled.
Fantastic. And in fact,
Flash Arts Flying Circus. They're brilliant.
Yeah, Flash Arts Flying Circus. Yeah, that's a favourite. And then yes, Winkle Brown in a Flash Gordon style was another new one. So that you can find all these at projectcancelled.com. It's been a sort of it's just fun. I really, really enjoy trying to put together some of these some sort of T-shirts for av geeks, aviation geeks, aviation enthusiasts who I've always felt have not been as well served by kind of apparel makers as fans of cult movies have been. So yeah, Hopefully there's a little bit of sort of, you know, wit and style where we sort of mash together, you know, Vulcans and Dambusters and Star Wars, lots of sort of James Bond spoofs, you know, pilot's notes T-shirts for the little microjet that that Roger Moore flew, or even pilot's notes T-shirts for the Union Jack parachute he used after skiing off a cliff. Really good. There's a couple. There's a handful more coming through, not least a couple more Sea Harrier ones relating to the Falklands War. So again, sort of playing with things which I hope will be familiar to people. So there's sort of celebrate. There's some American ones, some British ones, some that relate to books and movies, some to sort of intriguing bits of hidden history. But hopefully They're sort of, I mean, some even that relate to David Bowie's Major Tom. I hope they're all, by and large, T-shirts which are just not so horrible looking that you'd consider giving them to somebody who had no interest in aviation at all, just because they were quite striking and cool pieces of graphic design. So that I really, really enjoy doing those T-shirts. So Project Castle.
I love it, the new batch. You need one now with a picture of like a, you know, a Rafale ejection seat with you know, do not touch in French.
You're absolutely right. You'll get your 10% commission for that, Tim.
Very good.
I mean, that's about, unless you've got any more. I mean, look at the time now. I mean, we could talk Sea Harriers, Falklands, Canberras, all night, all day. Unless you've got anything else to add, Peter.
No, I just can't wait. I just can't wait for it to come out.
Yeah, really, really good.
Yeah, I'm really excited, Roland. As you know, Peter, we to celebrate the 35th anniversary, we ran four episodes, and I, without a shadow of a doubt, have been our most popular episodes ever. I think the Sharky Ward one, Tim Gedge, Commander Tim Gedge. And interestingly enough, the Argentine angle was a very, very popular episode. So you absolutely are onto something. People will really snap this up. So very excited, really, really looking forward to it. So thanks so much for all that and for your time tonight.
Well, thanks so much for having me on again. I mean, I'll be a little bit further down the line with the Dam Buster book in October. So
we'll maybe get you back then.
When you said it felt like we'd been talking all night, or we could talk all night, I sort of suddenly looked at the time and realized we sort of pretty much have been talking all night. if you've got an appetite for it in October, let's do it again.
Well, listen, guys, let's take a quick break, and then we'll come back and we'll do some promoting aerospace.
Hi, Mick Oakey here, managing editor of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. Thanks to our friends at Extended, I've got a few minutes here to give you a privileged sneak preview of our new issue, TAH 31, officially published on April the 15th. I'm recording this slot a whole fortnight earlier, while we're scrambling to get copies out early to our UK and overseas subscribers, because we're seeing increasing restrictions on postal services worldwide, owing to the coronavirus pandemic. We don't want to get caught out if there's a further lockdown. So, to the new issue. TAH 31's cover story is about the Northrop F5 Tiger in Swiss Air Force service. Author Peter Lewis also took the superb air-to-air photographs which accompany the article, and the front cover image positively sizzles. It's a twilight shot taken over the Alps of an F5 banking hard to starboard, its underside bathed in the glow of the chaff flares it's just fired off. Breathtaking. Another major feature in this issue is about flying the Hump in World War II. The Hump, of course, being the high-level air transport route over the Himalayas between China and India. Established operations on that route have been well covered elsewhere over the decades, but what hasn't been examined in detail is how it was first set up in 1942 in an extraordinary four-way cooperative venture by two military air forces, the RAF and USAAF, and two civilian operators, the China National Aviation Corporation and the African offshoot of Pan Am. Elsewhere in the new issue, Professor Keith Hayward takes a forensic look at the political exasperations of the Anglo-French variable geometry project of the 1960s, which eventually led to the Panavia tornado. And we also get inside the Bristol Hercules sleeve valve engine with the aid of some remarkable full-colour CAD artworks of its innards. Going back in time to just after World War I, we look at the work of obscure French inventor Louis Domblon, who created the Alerion, a kind of early tilt rotor. Its twin side-by-side rotors each had four very wide-cored blades, so they were shaped like shamrock leaves. And each rotor was powered independently via long shafts and bevel gears by its own Lirone rotary engine. What could possibly go wrong? Other articles this time include secret German and Soviet interwar experiments with airborne chemical weapons, the World War II-era Douglas 8A ground attacker in Peruvian service, early Italian airlines, and the first half of an interview recorded in 2005 by my colleague Nick Stroud, our editor, with the late Lieutenant Colonel Fern Villeneuve, AFC, the founding leader of the Royal Canadian Air Force's Golden Hawks aerobatic display team. Right, time's up. Remember, our journal is not on sale in newsagents, but you can order it online via our website, theaviationhistorian.com, from the evening of April the 14th onwards. Until next time, then, this is Mick Oakey talking exclusively to Extended.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
Okay, over to promoting aerospace, shout outs and mentions for the industry. Tim, got anything to mention?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, we're in the aviation industry is in a bit of a crisis at the moment, and there's lots of people who are, you know, got job uncertainty or, you know, recently been sort of laid off or furloughed, or if you're a student. So this is just basically a shout out to say, even though the Royal Aeronautical Society HQ is closed, we're all remotely working, and the RAS Careers Service is still online, and they're doing one-to-one. They'll do one-to-one Skypes with you. They're still doing giving out free advice. So if you are one of these unfortunate people who've been affected, or you're worried about, you know, what's going to happen in the future, and you want some decent impartial advice, get in touch with the Royal Aeronautical Society Careers Service, and they can, you know, they might be able to help.
And Tim, do you have to be a member to get that advice?
You do not, no.
So there you go. You know, even if you're not a member, they're there to support the industry. Great shout, actually, Tim. Just heard from Mick Oakey there, and it's publications like The Aviation Historian that are really suffering at the moment. And in their latest issue, where they talk about the hump and Himalayan transport in 1942, you will not find features like that anywhere else. So please do give The Aviation Historian a look up. I'd also like to give a mention to Simon Jakubowski. Many of you know he runs the Facebook Aviation Enthusiasts Book Club, and it's gone from strength to strength, and it's a really fantastic place if you are interested in aviation books. And he put out a message recently that I just want to read out, because I think is a great shout. So he says, as we make our way through these extraordinary times, I've a bit of a request. Amazon will survive. It's huge and has diverse forms of income. So when thinking of buying your next book, please consider one of the many book traders found here on the group. Most only trade in aviation and military titles, and their exposure to the buying public has been hugely limited now due to numerous events being cancelled. They offer a friendly personal service, and as we've seen here, they also give several fantastic discounts and deals to people on this group to take advantage of. Likewise, I'd like to ask all the book traders to keep us informed of what you have in stock, along with details on ordering. Let's all support each other and protect the future of our hobby. Most postal services are performing sterling work in maintaining the delivery of our goodies, so be sure to give your postie a thumbs up and a thanks when you see them too. Thanks for listening. I think that was a great message from Simon to support the aviation and aerospace book industry. If you can, order from the publishers or from the authors. A lot of them are on the group. And if you don't subscribe to the group and you're on Facebook, you should really be there. So it's a fantastic place. So thanks for that, Simon. Couple of other mentions. Ed Jackson contacted us recently. Now, Ed Jackson is one of those very, very clever people who runs a page called plainencyclopedia.com, plain-encyclopedia.com. But he's also a graphic designer and does some fantastic aircraft designs and montages. So do give him a look up. Fantastic stuff. It's a great website, by the way, with some lovely information. But we particularly were interested by his aviation graphics. Finally, it is the 50th anniversary of the moon landings, of course. And more recently, we've seen a lot of activity about Apollo 13. So shout out to NASA. They've got about 200 free ebooks that they distribute. We'll put a link in the show notes. So loads of topics from aerospace, aviation, right through to space exploration. They're all free. It's part of the deal from NASA. I think that's about it. We'd like to thank White Hearts and Peter Dixon for their contributions to the show. We'd also like to thank Mick Oakey and the team at the Aviation Historian for helping to promote the programme. If you feel able, please leave us some feedback on iTunes or your podcast playing app. Like and score us on our Facebook page. We really mean it. We've got both negative and positive feedback in there. We're not hiding them. We're not deleting them. You know, people say their piece about what they think about the show. I'm glad to say most of them are positive, but please do leave us that feedback. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme is produced with a Creative Commons licence. Okay, Tim, where can we find you online?
Okay, I found tweeting at RAS Tim R, and the Royal Aeronautical Society is www.aerosociety.com.
And Roland, where can we find you online?
Well, as I mentioned, the projectcancel.com is the t-shirt website. Rolandwhite.com, Roland with a W, is my own website, updated far too infrequently. So the best place really is Roland White, or at Roland White on Twitter. Again, R-O-W-L-A-N-D, Roland White, at Roland White on Twitter, is where I'm going to continue to sort of post news of the book coming up between now and obviously October 14th when it's published. But I think even though there's a little time to wait until publication, you can pre-order. So I don't know how many of those shops that Simon is representing on Facebook are taking pre-orders, but I'm sure they would welcome the opportunity to take those pre-orders for Harrier 809, because this is shameless. If you are inclined to pre-order it, and certainly Waterstones do as well. So I'm sure the next 6 months will speed by.
You've got great presence on Twitter at the moment. There's some great content there. So, yeah, watch this space. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. And, of course, you can see Extended at Aviation Extended, or one word, no leading E, on Twitter and, of course, on Facebook. That's it. With the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye all. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from Roland White.
Thanks very much. Good night.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme.
The cockpit's very cramped, you've got leg restraints on, you're sat on a seat that's got explosives in it.
Just taken me on the trip of a lifetime in a F-18F Super Hornet.
Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Always fun and a pleasure. I never come away without learning something new from you, Roland. Welcome back to Extended. Roland, you're on mute. Hello, Roland.
I'm really sorry, guys. I don't know why. That's ridiculous. So sorry.
That's all right.
All that build up as well. You have to do it all over again.
I was just too embarrassed.
At times like these, but what a great publication it is, and their latest feature-packed booklet. I'll edit that.
Apologies. Issue.
Oh well, we got two bloopers now. Better say that again.
Extend it.
This is XTP Media.